can get a law passed, but if it's not funded, it's not real. If it's not implemented, it's not real. And so the budget is about making people's dreams real. Historically, even currently, the allocation of resources is deeply unfair.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to A More Perfect District, a podcast from the ACLU of DC. We work to protect and advance civil liberties and civil rights for people who live in, work in, and visit DC, in court, in the legislature, and in the street. I'm your host for this episode, Monica Hopkins, Executive Director of the ACLU DC. Each episode, we take a deep dive into the civil rights and civil liberties issues shaping Washington, D.C. today and explore how we can protect our rights and move closer to a more just and free D.C. The D.C. Council plays a major role in shaping the policies and budget that impact our daily lives. But for many residents, how it actually works can feel unclear or out of reach. Today, I'm joined by Alicia Yass, Policy Director from the ACLU D.C., and Catherine Lanfield of the Fair Budget Coalition to break down what the council does, how decisions get made, and how everyday DC residents can advocate for their rights and future.
Hi, Alicia. It's really great to see you.
Hey, Monica. It's great to be here with you today.
So we're going to talk a little bit about DC, DC statehood, DC home rule. And I'm wondering, a good place to start might be with DC home rule. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So home rule has been in effect since 1973. It was a law passed by Congress because they're the ones who had control over DC and technically still do. But in some ways that shifted in 1973 to allow for more local control over our government. So that created the DC Council, the mayor. So in effect, DC sort of works like a unicameral legislative state. We have the one legislative body, and then we have the executive branch under the mayor. And they create laws and provide the services that we enjoy to keep DC functioning. So that ranges from things like trash collection, which obviously we need, to things like education policy and funding our schools or our criminal justice policy and how we're going to carry about our laws for crime. So all of those things are handled on the local level through our DC Council and the executive. But there are, and it gets complicated here, with how Congress still has oversight over all of that.
Yeah, so it's always been interesting to me that when you look at DC, it functions both as the city that people know it as, doing all those municipal functions, but it also essentially is like a state. Our council is that unicameral legislature, and we have our own sort of public safety budget and education budget. But do you want to tell me a little bit more about that Congress intervention and how our laws actually get to be laws?
Yeah. So the way our laws go, we have the first step, which is the DC process. So that'll be a bill will get introduced in the council. The council can introduce bills themselves. The mayor and the attorney general can also actually introduce bills in our system, and they'll get introduced to council. They'll get referred to a committee who will hold hearings, learn about the issue, maybe adjust the bill depending on the feedback they hear during that process. And then council actually takes two votes on all legislation. So they take a first vote, and then there has to be at least 2 weeks that pass, and then they take a second vote. And that is when it is enrolled, is what it's called. So that means it's been passed by the council. It then goes to the mayor. The mayor can sign it. The mayor can let it go unsigned, it would still go into effect, or the mayor can veto. If it is signed or just the date passes, then it is in effect, sort of. But at that point is when it goes to Congress. And Congress gets a 30-day review period for civil legislation and a 60-day review period for criminal legislation. And during that review period, they can pass a disapproval resolution, which would stop the bill from going into effect. We've been seeing more and more of this happen recently in the history of home rule. It's actually been a very rare occurrence. And in the past couple of years, we've been seeing more of that happen. But we are still plugging along and passing our laws and making things happen to keep the district functioning.
What are the other couple of ways that sort of Congress can intervene? There's like the legislative process and disrupting the implementation of our laws. But I know there are a couple of other ways. And can you tell us about them?
There certainly are. So the disapproval is they're not meddling in the legislation. They're not changing the law. They're just saying this law is not going into effect. But Congress can still pass actual legislation about the district. So the same way they pass bills that change laws for the whole country, they can pass bills that are specific and change the law in DC. So going into our DC code, changing what has been passed. So that sort of gives them almost a second bite at the apple. If they didn't disapprove of legislation that went into effect a year, 2 years later, they can be like, hey, we don't really like this. We're going to pass a new law that changes the DC code. So that's one way they can do it. And that the process for that is what everyone knows, how a bill becomes a law, what we learn in, you know, school growing up in our civics classes. And then there's other ways that are a little more hidden, not as obvious. There's riders, which are sort of pieces of legislation that get attached to other legislation that is happening. We often see this for DC getting attached to appropriations. There will be an appropriations bill going through Congress to fund the federal government, so fund budget for the entire country. And a legislator will attach something that says, oh, DC can't use local funds to pay for abortion. That one has been in effect. It comes up every year and gets added to the appropriations every year. So things like that are another way that Congress can meddle. And the Senate has so many rules, like going through the list of rules of things that can happen would take us hours. But just it's basically there are many, many ways that Congress can interfere in the district, which is particularly frustrating for those of us who live here because we don't vote for the people who are in Congress.
It's so interesting when you learn that, you know, it's the way I think about it is, you know, in civics class, that civics lesson within a civics lesson, we're a city that acts like a state and passes our own laws. So if we said we were the state of Wisconsin, it would be like sending our laws to the state of Utah and saying, okay, now you have a review process, state of Utah, you can tell us whether or not we can put our laws into effect or whether we, are on your budget, the money we raise from our taxpayers are on your budget, or hey, Utah, do you want to pass laws for the state of Wisconsin? Which I think is then, do we have a civics? Do we have a solution to this?
I mean, the solution that would fix everything at one time is statehood. Obviously, there are other incremental changes that could be made, strengthening home rule or various other things that would limit some of these problems. Statehood is what would fix all of them. It would allow DC to act like Wisconsin, to act like Utah, and not have Congress interfering in what we were doing with our own local affairs, right? Obviously, Congress is still going to be passing laws that affect the whole country, but our country is set up, America is set up with federalism, with this like local control. And the way DC is created is totally the opposite of what everyone believes in with this federation of states that we have and how federalism is supposed to work and what local control is supposed to mean and what even many members of Congress espouse about local control when they are talking about other places besides DC.
Yeah, and it's always interesting as an organization who relies on the Constitution, how many people say, oh, you know, it's not constitutional to make DC a state when, in fact, our Constitution says that the seat of the federal government can't be any more than, 10 miles wide. And we could reduce the size of the federal government here and give DC statehood.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the capital that would be separate from DC could be shrunk down to really just like the land that Congress is on, the land that the White House is on, maybe some other federal buildings. But I think what people also don't understand is there are federal buildings in other states. You know, the federal government has buildings in every state. There are federal courts in every state.
Federal parks.
There's outposts of the Department of Agriculture, Department of Interior. They exist in all these states. And yet that doesn't affect how the state runs. That land is federally owned. And that's how that operates. And that would be the same in the district. There would be certain places that would be federally owned land. But outside of that, it would be the state.
So, moving sort of from statehood and the federal intervention and stuff, let's dig down into the DC Council. So how open is the DC Council to DC residents and organizations and, you know, folks who want to come to their government and talk about what they want and what they don't want in their city?
Yeah. So our DC Council is set up in a way, and the processes that they follow really allows for a lot of opportunities for public input. There are hearings on most bills that go through the council. Emergency legislation is sort of a little exception, but most bills that go through the council have hearings in front of one of the committees. So the committees are broken up sort of by issue area. So one that we're in front of a lot is the Committee for Judiciary and Public Safety. So they oversee the police department, the Attorney General's office, all of these things. And so any bill that's touching on the criminal justice system is going to go through that committee, and they're going to have a hearing on those bills. And at hearings, the public is encouraged to speak. The council actually makes it fairly easy. I can even show you. So if you go to the council website, which is just dccouncil.gov, there's a calendar right here. It's easy to get to. And it shows you these are all hearings that are happening. So you can click on any one of them. See what bills they're talking about, click on those bills, learn what they are, and you can sign up to testify. They try to make testifying easy. You can testify during the time of that hearing. So that was a Wednesday at 12 p.m. You might not be available Wednesday at 12 p.m. Many people with jobs can't get away from them to go testify, but you can also submit testimony for the record. You do not have to attend the hearing in person or even attend it virtually while it is happening. You can submit testimony either written, just type out your thoughts and submit them in. You can also record a voice recording, a video recording, and upload that as well.
I think I knew that. Prefer.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. So it's accessible for many different people. Writing might not be something you're comfortable with or something you're good at, but maybe you want to talk out what you want to say. They'll take that too. So they really do make it easy. You can submit it in advance of the hearing and also after the hearing. Most hearing records are open for 2 weeks after the hearing, so you have that time to get it in. So maybe you want to hear what other people say at the hearing and then respond to that. You're able to do so. So it's really open for anybody. Organizations can do it. We often testify on behalf of the ACLU DC. But if you're just a resident of DC and you're like, hey, this issue affects me, you're talking about the schools and I have a kid in DC public schools and I want to have my voice heard, or your kid might want to say something about DC schools, they're welcome to do that too. Or if you're like, hey, I'm not happy with our trash collection. It hasn't been good. I know that was a recent issue for a lot of people with the snowstorm. And there was a hearing. Council had a hearing on how DPW handled that, and people could go and share their experiences. So there are all of those opportunities to go. The benefit of going live or going either in person or virtual, both options are open for most hearings the day of, is that you're actually interacting with the council members on the committee. So the chairman will most likely be there and other members of the committee may be there as well. So after you give your testimony, they can ask you questions. So that is, there is some benefit to going on the actual time of the hearing, but again, plenty of opportunities if that's not going to work for you.
I always love going in person too, because you get to be in person and hear the people who go before you and what their concerns are. And it's really interesting to be in the room when those things are actually happening.
Yeah.
And it also, it's really interesting because coming from another state that has 100 or 200 sort of state legislatures, we have 13 council members who are highly accessible and, you know, at the council, but also our neighbors too. So it's just always really impressed me.
Yeah. And they do also have, they all have offices in the Wilson building as well. And constituents can go stop in their offices. I can't promise you'll get to meet the council member themselves, but staff is always there and they will talk to you too.
So what are some of the common questions that you hear about the DC council or lawmaking in the district?
I think a lot of people, you know, get frustrated and they're like, what's the point? And I think that's with our government in general right now. I think people are dealing with a lot of frustration. But I think that's even more reason to go and say what you need to say, right? I mean, there's the cathartic aspect of just getting out what you need to say. I mean, there's that benefit as well. But it's also, as you said, other people are feeling that same thing and might hear you, and we can uplift each other's voices. I think you're right. That's one of the benefits I feel like whenever I'm at council and testifying in person, I hear other people. And then when I'm giving my testimony, if I have a point that's similar to somebody else's, I can say, you know, as this other person said, we also feel X, Y, and Z, and we can be uplifting each other and finding that community and finding those connections to other people where we can work together.
Yeah, that what's the point thing. I always think about, you know, someone's having a party and you're like, oh, but other people are going to go, and then nobody shows up, and then you're just more frustrated, yeah. Right? So it's important that we show up, because that's the only way that our government knows that people care and can make changes, so you're not frustrated, hopefully.
Exactly.
As a final question, I kind of want you to take off your ACLU DC hat and talk to me as a district resident. So how long have you lived in the district, and what do you love most about DC?
Yeah, so I've actually lived in the district twice. I originally came here for undergrad. I went to GW, so I was here in 2001 when I started college, and I was here for the 4 years of college, and then I was working in DC for a couple of years. I ended up leaving for law school, left for a couple of years, and then came back in 2011 for a job here as a lawyer and started working in the district. And then I've been here ever since. So I have spent a great deal of my adult life in the district, and I am a DC resident. I've lived mostly in Northwest, but I've lived in Van Ness, Columbia Heights, and now I'm in Poutworth. So, you know, experiencing different communities, different parts of the district. I do love the district and so much. I mean, I have worked for the federal government. I've worked for Congress. So there is that piece of it that's here that's special about DC and that draws people here. But there's so much about DC outside of that too. I'm a big theater lover, and DC actually has a really amazing theater scene. I was actually just at a show last night at Woolly. I got to see Sasha Velour at Woolly Mammoth, which was amazing.
And I went to see one of your plays because you participate in the theater.
Correct, yes. DC Community Theater as well. So, you know, all of that is really great. We have such great food from our various different immigrant communities that they bring to the district, and that we can all be a part of. So I really do love that community and love seeing how much exists here. And even those people who, you know, everyone is always like, well, there's the federal government and then there's DC. But a lot of DC are people who work in and are part of the federal government. It is connected, but it is a lot more than that. It's arts, it's culture, it's people living their lives. My next door neighbors have lived in DC for generations, and it's that as well. So seeing all of that just really makes DC such a community. And in some ways, it feels so small that 10 square miles feels small. And in some ways, it feels enormous.
Yeah. There's a lot packed into the little 10 miles that are DC.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me today. And it was really great talking to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me and for doing this.
So, Catherine, can you tell us a little bit about your background and sort of how you got here?
Sure. So I am a longtime DC social worker. I was in direct services for somewhere north of 25 years, and I really kind of hit the wall. I got so tired of the families I worked with having the same issues over and over again. And I finally thought, you know what? My families need something more from me. They need for me to go into structural change. They need better policy. They need a better budget. they need the ability to thrive, and they do not have that. And so I left direct services, which was incredibly hard, and joined the world of, you know, kind of policy, advocacy, organizing, like anything I could do to make the move into larger systems change.
And can you tell us a little bit about your role at Fair Budget?
Sure. I am the person at Fair Budget who leads on advocacy. I'm the senior advocacy strategist, which means that I'm helping our coalition members to plug into advocacy, to plan strategic moves, to develop an arc of escalation, and also to really collaborate with the organizers in the coalition so that we are really building people power as well as inside game power.
Yeah, you said something about your background when it comes to policy that I think is so important, which is it's sort of like rooted in what people need and that government should be responsive to. And so can you tell me a little bit more about the work of the Fair Budget Coalition and what it does overall?
Yes. So Fair Budget Coalition is, I believe, the oldest racial equity focused advocacy organization in DC. And we convene a coalition to really bring organizations and community members together across the range of issues that people are facing. So we cover community safety, economic justice, education, fair taxes and public deals, housing security, food access, and health justice. And when we stand across all those issues, we are able to get changes that really are good for whole communities, because communities don't just have single needs. And so if the government is saying, well, this year we're really going to lean into housing, but we can't actually address healthcare, we're here to say, actually, that doesn't work for community members. We really need to be standing across all these issue areas, and that's what our members do.
And so from what I'm hearing, that's what you would call a fair budget. And so could you unpack that a little bit for us?
So, you know, the budget is the story of values and choices. And
I always say that to my staff, too. Yeah.
And it is also the story of how we allocate resources. And historically, and even currently, the allocation of resources is deeply unfair. And Black and brown working class residents have really been frozen out of a tremendous amount of, you know, policies that would make the conditions for them to be able to thrive and not just survive. And so a fair budget is one that's restorative. It's one that's racially equitable. It's one that is just. And again, it works across all those issue areas and doesn't leave big holes in the budget. It is also, I think it's really important to highlight, you can get a law passed, but if it's not funded, it's not real. If it's not implemented, it's not real. And so the budget is about making people's dreams real.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one of the things about policy where everyone sort of rallies around it and says, this is great. And, you know, the great pieces of policy, legislators can pat themselves on the back.
Yeah.
Everyone feels great. And then you walk away and it has
and
no
it disappears.
Effect.
It just goes up like in steam, like it vaporizes.
Yeah. And to your point, the folks who really needed it to thrive and really wanted that policy are the ones who really are affected and have no change. So I'm wondering, can you tell me a little bit about that advocacy at the DC Council, what it's like sort of behind the scenes?
Sure. So a lot of what I do is talking. I do a lot of listening, a lot of asking questions. I go to meet with council offices, really try to understand what they're trying to do, and honestly try to push them in the direction that our coalition thinks they should be going. One thing that's really, really important that I really enjoy is helping community members plug into the budget process. And the budget is extremely not transparent. People need to be able to understand what's happening. They need to be able to make sense of what's happening and really be able to have an analysis that lets them step into their own power in advocating for the budget that they deserve.
I think that's one of the things I love about the Fair Budget Coalition, because as an organization that watches multiple issues, you bring together people who have expertise in issues that an organization like ours may just sort of scrape the surface. Mm-hmm. And when you can see, oh, you know, folks who are caring deeply about healthcare because they're in it every day and understand it better than we do, you can see what's going on in the budget that sort of affects policy and how policy affects healthcare in other places you might not usually look.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. It does sometimes feel like if we're not really in conversation pretty much in every direction across issues, across types of expertise, whether it's lived experience expertise or like super fancy policy chops, if we're not in dialogue, we are just not getting the best. We're not making the best impact that we can.
It feels like solidarity.
It's definitely solidarity. It's also smart.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Starting there.
Yeah.
So can you share with me a moment that like constituent advocacy really, really made a difference?
Oh, okay. So the most important thing to say is that there really is no big win that doesn't involve constituents. When constituents are not at the table, or sometimes flipping the table to be at the table, we don't get those big wins.
And I really, in what you said, love that your organization was thinking not only how do we fix this issue right now here, but sort of seeing into the future on the horizon what the impacts could be down the road, which sometimes is a hard thing to do when you're trying to do the immediacy of policy.
People do not love to look 5-10 years down the road. They do for investing in like for-profit things. They don't seem to like doing that as much in investing in people, investing in communities. And this is something that our coalition is always uplifting, like invest in the people. The best thing you can do for the economy is to invest in your communities. Mm-hmm. Can I give one other example?
Oh, you can totally give another example.
So another example of constituents really changing the whole way something is happening is with the Healthcare Alliance. Mm. Really, quite surprisingly, last year, the mayor really cut very, very hard, cut that program. And there are so many families, so many working class and poor folks who depend on that program for healthcare. And we're at the point, this is, you know, getting to that idea of connection and interconnectedness. What does it mean to have a workforce that is unable to access healthcare? What does it mean to have employees who are either too sick to work or who are unable to take care of themselves and their children? Is that really the kind of workforce we want? It's certainly not what we want for communities. But if we only look at it from the point of view of either dollars and cents, like, oh, it's too expensive and the costs are rising. Well, who doesn't know that their healthcare costs are rising?
Exponentially.
Right? Mm. We know that, but that's where government really has an important role to play. And this program was so well designed to get working class folks the care that they needed, particularly if they weren't eligible for Medicaid. And when the community learned of what was happening, they mobilized. We had crowds in like of 30 and 40 people going office to office. And when I say we, I'm not trying to take the credit. I was not organizing that group, but the Keep DC Healthy Coalition, which is, you know, a lot of their members are our members. They were going to offices. They had parents, nurses, educators, doctors were taking time out of their shifts to come and say, you cannot do this to our patients. People are going to die. And the way that the community came together was really powerful. And it's really shifted the whole discussion. There was a time when it looked like the entire program was just gonna, you know, quietly
go away,
deep sixed, and not anymore, not anymore.
It's so powerful because to think about 30 people, you know, some folks listening might say, oh, it's 30 people. And we're talking 30 people who have other lives because our government works essentially 9 to 5 to be open for constituents. That is incredibly powerful, especially because I'm sure your organization, like our organization, when I go, I tell people, you know, I could talk till I'm blue in the face and tell other people's stories. But when even one person shows up and tells their story, right, it just has such an impact.
Right. Absolutely. That was some very powerful storytelling with people representing themselves and saying, this is what it's going to mean in my life. So that kind of advocacy really is a game changer.
So for someone who's listening right now and who's never engaged before, what's one simple concrete thing that they can do to get involved?
Oh, you're giving me such a softball.
Oh,
okay. First of all, learn more about the budget. Think about what the budget means in your own life. The sidewalks you're walking on, the libraries you're stopping into, the schools you're taking your children to, the healthcare you might be using, the childcare subsidies you might be using. All of these things are the story of the budget. And the more you stop and think about those things, the more you're going to realize, actually, I should be at that table. I should be checking in on this. I don't want to see my library in that crumbling state or closing in limited hours. So learn. And the reason I said it's a softball is because we would love for everybody to join as an individual member of the coalition. I think that's probably...
Yeah. Do you want to give people your website? Because I've found your website really helpful with resources about the budget and plugging in different ways.
Okay. So thank you for that opportunity. Our website, it's really basic. You don't even need to get your pen out. Fairbudget.org.
You're keeping it simple.
Fairbudget.org. We are very straight shooters. We are going to just lay it out there. So go to fairbudget.org. And the thing I did forget to mention, one of the really best ways people can start to learn about the budget, take a look at our community built budget platform. Mm. And that is the very first thing you're going to see when you go to our website. And that is a platform with budget recommendations that have been built by community members and organizational members over the course, mostly over the course of the fall. And then we have this very participatory process where people vote and we discuss it in community. And it's just sort of, I wish I had brought it. I'd hold it.
I know. I highly recommend it. It's sort of why I prompted you. It's really a beautiful sort of what do you care about in your community platform, and gives a different way to think about how you do the budget in your city, which to get it done, we have to sort of engage with the council.
Absolutely.
Well, I have one question left for you. So as someone who lives in the DMV, how long have you lived in the area and what makes it so special for you?
even though we have a reputation for being a transient city, I love actually how rooted there are so many rooted communities in DC. I love it that I know the rooted communities and that I don't feel transient and that I do feel like this is home.
That's it for this episode of A More Perfect District, a podcast from the ACLU of DC. I'm Amber Taylor, Strategic Communications Director. Thanks for spending time with us. Join us next time as we break down the civil rights and civil liberties issues impacting Washington, D.C. For show notes and ways to take action right now, visit acludc.org/podcast. And don't forget to follow, rate, and share this podcast to help more people stay informed. Till next time.